It's a pleasure for me to be here. Ions was kind of like meeting an old friend. I spoke at Ions a couple of years ago, and for many years I did not talk about my experience. I didn't even talk to family members about it. I knew what had happened to me, but I didn't share that. I figured it was just for me. Ions provided a place where I felt safe. Safe enough just to share honestly what happened. And that's all I'll do tonight. I don't sensationalize anything. I just say what my experience was. I have no agenda. There's nothing to prove. I'm literally just sharing. This is what happened to me. This was my experience. And it's a pleasure to do that in a place where I feel safe and comfortable. And I want to give you a little bit of background about me before I dive into everything that happened. I grew up here in Utah, grew up in a little town known as Charleston. It's right up by Midway on Deer Creek Reservoir. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world. You sit right there on the lake and you look up at Mount Tippinogus, and it's really a beautiful place. And when I was in Charleston, it was about 6 farms. That's all it was. So I grew up as a little farm boy. We had dairy cows, we had pigs, we had horses. We also had another ranch over in a place called Wallsburg. Has anyone ever heard of Wallsburg? Wow. This is the first time I've ever said Wallsburg and people know where that is. But we had an Angus beef ranch over in Wallsburg. So I grew up riding horses and milking cows. And of course, in Heber, which was the city, I went to Wasatch High School. And there I played football and wrestled and was on the rodeo team. So I grew up with brothers too. There was 3 boys in the family. And we were very close. My oldest brother and my youngest brother, I was smack dab in the middle, and there was only 4 years between the 3 of us. So it was like bang, 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 and there we were, and we rodeoed together, we played football together, we wrestled together. And if you know anything about Wasatch High, wrestling was a religion. It was not a sport, it was a religion to wrestle at Wasatch High. And yet my real love was football. It was easier. I loved going really hard for 8 or 10 seconds and resting for 25 and catching my breath. But I had a great family. My brothers were very close. My dad was there. My mom and dad had divorced when I was young, so it was kind of a guy's place. I stayed with my mom here in Salt Lake in Holiday until I was about 13, and then moved with my brothers up with my dad and just grew up on the farm. Although my parents were separated and divorced, they were very good about it. They honored each other. We shared time between both parents and saw plenty of dad, saw plenty of mom, and they were very cordial and loving and kind to us as children. There was no animosity or bad feelings or ill talk. I honor my parents to this day because never once did my mom say, well, your dad, blah, 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 and never once did my dad ever say, well, your mom. My father was honored by my mother, and my mother was honored by my father, even though they were not married anymore. And as I've grown older and seen a lot of life, I become more and more grateful for how exceptional that was. Loving family, good brothers. My brothers were my best friends. We did everything together. We went and played sports. We went to all the dances. We even dated the same girls. It was really weird, you know. I mean, we'd come home and compare notes, and we got into all kinds of trouble, everything from throwing eggs at the Heber creeper when it would come by to just, you know, silly, rough and tumble, mischievous things. I tell you this so you get that I was a normal kid. I grew up as a normal person. There was always a sense of spirituality. I grew up in a Christian home, was taught honesty and integrity, but really didn't have anything abnormal about me or about my experience at all, except just growing up and knowing as I looked around and saw the beauty around me that there was more to it, that I wasn't just a biological mistake that was going through my life and would then die and be done. I felt a cosmic power even in watching the alfalfa grow. I mean, you can't grow up on a farm and watch crops grow and raise animals and see baby calves born and not witness the miracle that is the things of every day. I was in touch with that. I felt that. I used to lay out in the hay fields late at night. We would fresh cut the hay and then let it dry and bale it. And my favorite thing would be to go out in the hay field and lay on the bales of hay and just look up at the stars. And if you've ever been out in the country when it's dark at nighttime, you can see the stars, and you can see lots of them. And that was the pastime when I wasn't doing sports or working, and we worked hard. We didn't have a lot of spare time. I mean, we worked hard between a dairy farm and a beef ranch and all the things that went with it. There wasn't a lot of time for messing around, so we made play of our work and came very close. Had a good relationship with my mom, great relationship with my dad. Anyway, grew up and went away to college. I received a football scholarship at Utah State. And this was back when they were really competitive. They had a good team last year, too, but they were a competitive team, and I went to Utah State, and I studied art. I always drew pictures and was very interested in art. I was going to be a fine artist. And when I went to college and tried to squeeze that all in, between getting up at 6:30 for weight training and then 7:30 breakfast and then class all day and then taping and stretching at 1 and practice started at 2:30 and it went till 7 and then there was team dinner. Then you had films to go watch films and then you had study hall and I wouldn't get any free time until about 10:30 at night. And trying to paint between 10:30 at night and 6 a.m. in the morning was a bit rough. I was getting about 4 hours of sleep because I'd paint till 2 o'clock and then crash and get up at 6 and get down to the weight room to maintain the scholarship. But I loved art and found that when I got into an advertising design program where I could do rough sketches and quick ideas and all the thought process, that was a newfound joy and a place where I could be creative. But it was outside of fine art that was so time consuming. And so life was really good. Great family life, was enjoying school, was studying, and really loved my body. I loved being in the body and had command of that and was very grateful for health and strength and to be able to run fast and things like that. I took it for granted then. I think I look back on it far more fondly now. I don't run anywhere now, but in my mind I do. School was going great. Everything was fantastic. I met a woman and fell madly in love. She was 20 and I was like 21. And I actually left. I left the country for 2 years and was gone, but we maintained a relationship through letters. I don't think people even write letters anymore. I'm getting old enough and gray enough now that a letter, it wasn't email, we were literally writing letters and sending them back and forth. But we maintained a relationship, and when I came home, still madly in love, and married her a few months after I returned back from, I was in Scotland, over in the UK, and started this life together. We had a first son, his name was Spencer, and he's now 21, almost 22 years old. He's in San Bernardino, California, and he's a very talented musician and a very good boy. He's tall, he's about 6'3" and bigger than me. And then we had another little guy about 5 or 6 years after that was named Griffin. He was more rough and tumble than me and my two brothers all put together. And he was just a bundle of energy and joy and maleness. He beat me up and he was 1 year old. You know, he was just a really, really fun kid. And life was good. I had started my career. That was skyrocketing. I had worked at agencies and worked on big things. I helped launch the Intel Inside campaign, and that was a springboard into other things. And I had just started my own advertising business with some partners, and that was springboarding as well. We were growing leaps and bounds and very profitable. And I just felt like life was golden. It's like everything I set out to do, I would accomplish. Everything I put intention in would unfold some way and manifest itself. And I got the rug ripped out from under me, I guess, in a way. We had packed up the car to go down to St. George. My wife's grandfather was very ill. He had Alzheimer's disease, and he was in a convalescent center. And it was going to be Easter weekend, and we decided to go visit him and spend time with him. And everyone said, well, he won't know who you are. He doesn't recognize anyone anymore. But we packed up the car and took this little pilgrimage from Salt Lake to St. George to go see him and visit, packed up the car and went. And when we got there, it was actually really amazing. He did remember who we were. We had a fantastic visit. He was very conscious, hugged and played with the grandkids, and we sat and visited with him, and then had a beautiful Easter Sunday the following day, and got up that Monday morning, packed the car to drive back to Salt Lake. And we put everybody in the car. Everyone was in seat belts. My little guy was in a car seat. and we headed northbound up I-15. I put the cruise control on 75, and we settled in for a comfortable ride home. And we talked a bit of the way, and everybody started getting tired. Tamara, my wife at the time, laid her seat back, and she said, "I'm going to have a rest." And I recall looking in the rearview mirror and seeing Griffin, my little guy, he was sound asleep in his car seat. And then Spencer was playing with little Star Wars toys that he had gotten in his Easter basket. The Easter Bunny had brought him some Star Wars toys, and he was playing with those. And I had a sense in that moment of pure gratitude. I was driving, and it's been 15 years, and it's still sometimes hard to talk about. But this overwhelming sense of thankfulness came over me. And that's one of the last things I remember. I don't know exactly what happened in the accident. I do know from the police reports that we swerved abruptly to the right, went off the road, I overcorrected, and the front suspension gave out, and the car continued to roll, not off the road, but down the road, 8 or 9 times. I received extensive injuries. Both my legs were crushed, my rib cage was crushed, my lungs were collapsed, my back was cracked in a couple of places. Didn't damage the spinal column, thankfully. My right shoulder was completely torn out. The rotator cuff was completely gone, and then it was severed in a way that they thought I might lose my right arm. And then the seat belt cut right through my core and ruptured all my intestines and everything else on the inside. That was nothing compared to the devastation of losing half my family. My wife and my youngest child were killed instantly in the wreck. They sustained head injuries that took their lives immediately. Now Spencer, he was 7 at the time. He broke his arm and he bruised his ribs up, but miraculously basically walked away from the accident. I've got to add some details here because as the car crashed, I don't recall all the details, but I do remember being wrecked and knowing it was bad. As far as I could tell, I was on the floorboard of the car. I was smashed down underneath the steering column. And for whatever reason, I couldn't see. I couldn't see what was going on around me. I did not see my wife or child, but I could hear Spencer. I could hear Spencer crying. And I knew he was okay. If he was crying, then he was okay. And as I grasped that knowledge that, oh, he's all right, then the nightmare hit me, but what about the others? Why don't I hear the baby crying, and where's my wife? And it hit me at that point that they were gone. I knew spiritually that they were gone, they were not there. And so I sat on the floorboard of the car, and I was trying to comfort Spencer, telling him, it's okay. And it felt like a lie because it wasn't okay. I didn't know how bad he was hurt. I knew I was slipping away quickly. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't see. Things were going dark. The last thing I remember is people running up to the car to assist me and hearing sirens. Now, interesting enough, the people who came running up to the car to assist me were doctors. There was a pediatrician that had stopped on the side of the road, saw the accident. And the next people on the scene were a husband and wife surgical team who actually had oxygen in their trailer. They had things to assist me. They had to get air into my lungs. They looked after Spencer. And I had the beautiful opportunity just 2 weeks ago of actually meeting the pediatrician that stopped by the scene of the accident. It's so funny how the universe works. My mother had written letters to the editor trying to find this kind doctor that had stopped at the scene. She had given up on that. It's like I say, it's been 15 years since this happened. And through a strange roundabout way and a number of new acquaintances, people put two and two together and said, oh, my brother-in-law was the doctor that stopped at your accident. And I was able to meet with him face to face and give him a hug and say thank you. He literally saved my life. But as they were trying to do that, and he, in hearing him talk about it, he knew that my wife and baby were gone, and he was dealing with that and caring for their bodies, which, how grateful am I for that? Somebody was able to deal with that and get Spencer away and put him in a safe place. and he thought I was gone too. The doctors never dreamed I would make it. His concern all these years has been what happened to that poor boy that was orphaned, and when he met me, he was thrilled to know that we had done just fine. But getting into the near-death experience, my near-death experience it's mine. It's different. It's not maybe the common one. But as things were going out, as I knew how bad it was and I was having the nightmare and the emotional distress of knowing, gosh, half the family's gone, Spencer's hurt, I'm slipping, suddenly I was in a place of peace. Now, I did not experience a tunnel. I didn't experience, it was almost just like walking from here to here. I was there and then I was here. But suddenly everything was light. It was beautiful. It was peaceful. There was no pain. I could see. I could hear. Everything was perfectly, perfectly clear. And the incredible thing about it is there with me was my wife, my deceased wife, who I knew at the scene was gone, but there she was. And she was embracing me, and she said to me, "You can't go. You can't stay." She said, "You have to go. You cannot stay here. You've got to go back." And that was tough. I didn't want to go. It was so beautiful, and I felt so much relief that there I was. It was okay. It was like going from hell to heaven all of a sudden like that, and knowing, oh, it's all okay, it's all okay. And then she was saying, "But you can't stay. You've got to go back. You've got to go back. You can't be here." And my heart was drawn to my son. I knew he was alive and well, and I did not choose to leave him orphaned. It was time to go back. Coming back, I didn't experience a tunnel. There was nothing. Everything was as quick as a thought. As soon as I thought it, boom, I was moving. There was no space. There was no time. And it was as if I was part of everything. The hardest thing about sharing this experience is articulating it and putting it into any any human language that works. But one of the most profound parts of this experience is as I came back, I found myself in the hospital, wandering about freely through the hospital. And I'm encountering people, the doctors, the nurses, the patients. And I'm encountering them in a very strange way. I realize that they are completely unaware of me, but I am acutely conscious of them. I know them perfectly. Every person I see, I know them. I know their love. I know their hate. I know their joy. I know their decisions. I know their motivations. And yet in that knowing them so deeply, I absolutely love them. I'm experiencing them in a way where they are me. Everyone I looked at or saw, I was so connected. I saw their soul. I saw who they were. I saw who they really were. I didn't see what they did or what they hadn't done or what happened to them or didn't happen to them. I saw them in this perfect perfection, this glorious child of God. And it was there. I would feel it. I knew it. Everyone I saw. In fact, I wanted to embrace them. I was like, oh, hi. You know, and I didn't know any of these people, or at least in this life I didn't know them. But in this experience, I was walking through, and it hit me that this is how God sees us. And it's funny, because of my upbringing, things flooded through my mind. I heard the words of Jesus saying, "And as much as you've done it to the least of these, if I was hungry, you fed me, or in prison, you visited me, and naked, and you clothed me, you did it to me." And it meant something different in that context, because I felt like, oh, He wasn't saying be nice to each other. He was saying we are one. That is me. I don't see myself as any better as that beggar in the street. That is us. We are all connected. And I felt this oneness, this unity, this absolute connection to everyone that I was encountering. Now, as I went through that process and moved through the hospital, I all of a sudden encountered a man laying on the gurney that I felt nothing from. There's nothing from this person. And I stepped closer to take a look and realized I was looking at me. I was looking at my body laying on this gurney. That was a strange experience, because when I saw it, I thought, boy, what a mess that is. It was almost repulsive to me to see, oh my gosh. And the second realization that I am not in there. That is not me. That is my body, but it's not me. It's not really who I am. And yet I felt drawn to it. I felt loved by it or for it. And again, knowing that I was to get back in the body as quick as a thought, I thought it and boom, and there I was. And then the pain and the grief. It's the most god-awful feeling I ever had, getting in that body and all that, you know, the tubes. I was respirated. That was a big thing down my throat to assist my lungs in breathing. And the injuries were extensive. But the grief was so much more than the physical things. The physical things almost seemed to be a distraction in some ways to the grief I was feeling. And yet I knew I had made a choice to come back and was there. And I was in and out of consciousness or coma I was in ICU for over 3 months. They had the respirator down me. The intestines were all open. They had to leave a lot of the wounds open because when the seatbelt had come through me, it infected everything. And so I had terrible infections. The wounds were all open. They were trying to save the leg, but it was eventually amputated. They weren't even dealing with the shoulder or anything else. And quite honestly, the doctors, which I have stayed in contact with, said they'd never seen anyone alive with those injuries, let alone survive them. And I should touch on that too, because there was a nurse and a doctor that came to see me after the fact. And they came into the room. This was when I was healing. I was almost ready to leave the hospital. I had 18 surgeries and was in the hospital for 6 months before they ever released me. And I was released in a wheelchair, and I couldn't use my right arm, and the leg was gone. And it was a strange thing, which I'll touch on later. But this doctor and nurse team came to see me in the hospital. And it was odd because it was at the time that I was just starting to receive visitors. And I thought, gosh, how do I know them? And I assumed they were a couple because this man and woman came in together. And I thought, are they from our church? No. Are they from work? No. Are they from the neighborhood? No. Couldn't place them. Anyway, they finally introduced themselves. They said, we're your trauma team. You were life flighted in. And we were the first team to kind of oversee your care and see to you. And I thought, wow, how kind is that? That they come and see me and they said, how are you doing? And I said, well, how does it look like I'm doing? I'm hanging in there. I'm breathing. Anyway, at this point, the nurse started to get a little emotional and they said, we have to tell you what happened, what we experienced as they brought you into our hospital, into that emergency care unit. And I perked up and said yes. And she was tearing by then. And she said, as I walked down the hall, she said, I went in there and she said, you are surrounded by light. You are surrounded by absolute light. And she said, I knew that it was your wife standing there. She said, I saw her. And she said, your deceased wife was standing with you as they brought your body in and was there. And I was, of course, by this time emotional, thinking about all of that. And she said, I felt it and I saw it. And then the doctor chimed up. Now, this is a clinical ER specialist, and he said, I felt it too. He said, I don't see things like that. I didn't see her, but he said, I felt it. And he said, she was communicating with me spiritually as to why you had to live. And he said, quite honestly, we didn't think you had a prayer. But he called in 5 surgeons, and they worked for over 8 hours on me just to save my life, because he felt the presence of my deceased wife saying, he's got to live. I've become very close to that doctor, and he's a dear friend of mine. So many people did so much, and I'm so grateful for what took place, but they shared this with me. They came to share this with me, that they'd had this experience. And it was so comforting to me, because I was a believer. I had been there. I'd been to the other side and come back. I knew there was life after. It wasn't a theory or a belief or a faith. I had literally experienced it. But to know the tenderness of my wife's care and love and what they had experienced and that what I had experienced in my reality was also someone else's reality was an interesting thing. And I don't know for sure, but I've tried to chronologically time it out, and that may have been the time that my wife was saying, you can't stay here, you've got to go. You've got to go back. I don't know. Time had no reason or meaning there. The interesting thing about my experience is maybe it was an out-of-body experience. I know I was near death, but the most profound thing that happened actually happened to me as I was getting ready to leave the hospital. I've had people question me and say, well, gosh, you were on a lot of morphine. It could be a morphine-induced high, and I was on a lot of morphine. I experienced that too. They gave me a self-pump. I could give myself all the morphine I wanted until I passed out, and that's what I would sit in the hospital and do. I'd get consciousness, and I'd hit that button. And then I'd hit that button again, and then I'd pass out. I actually became addicted to the morphine. Now, the nurse that was very kind, and I don't want to start crying about everybody who assisted me, but she assisted me to get off the morphine, to wean me off and get me stabilized. They talked about that and how I couldn't give myself enough to kill myself or anything else. They would keep the dosage that I would pass out before I'd hit that button enough times. But she talked about the spiritual things that were happening around me and what was going on. The point is, I experienced addiction, what that feels like, what that's like for people who are addicted to something and to have to come off that and to have the assistance to get me off. I don't know what people would do without that. Now, it was a strange circumstance, but I experienced that in the process. As I began to get well, I was no longer on morphine. I was no longer on anything except a little bit of lower tab because they had just repaired the shoulder, and I was getting ready to go home. My younger brother was staying with me in the hospital at that point. I can't say enough about my family. They literally, my brothers almost lost their jobs to be by my side. They would take days and weeks off. They would come and sit. My mom would come and sit in a chair and sleep in a chair just so that I would have somebody there. They were afraid for months that they were going to lose me. And then when they figured out I couldn't be killed, then they kind of eased up a little bit. But strange things happen. I actually threw not one but two pulmonary embolisms in the hospital. They're blood clots that go into your lungs, and that's supposed to kill you. But I had been sent back. Nobody knew as I had been sent back. I was not finished. I was not done, and I was not choosing to be done either. And so here I was. But as this was wrapping up, and I was healing and getting ready to come home, I was no longer heavily medicated, and my brother had come to visit, and we'd had a nice visit. And he was going to spend the night and sleep in the chair. I don't know why they did that, but I'm grateful they did. And I dozed off to sleep. I just went to sleep like any other time. In that sleep, I had a dream. That's all I can say. But suddenly, I realized I am out of the body again. I felt it. I knew, oh, I'm home. And that's all I can, that's the best word I know is I'm home. In this experience, I was in that place. I just felt it. I knew that I was there, and I felt that love and that knowing and that freedom. And I was, as I was walking through this place, I encountered a beautiful building, and I went in the building, and in the building was a very, very long corridor. I was making my way painlessly and effortlessly down that corridor. My arms were freely moving. My legs were both there. I was walking down the corridor and realized at the end of the corridor was a baby's crib. I made my way toward it, and as I got to it and looked in the crib, there was my little guy. And it doesn't matter how many times I tell this story, and I don't tell it that often, but I swept him up, and I just held him, and I was marveling that he is alive. I mean, I felt him. It was very physical. In fact, it was super tangible. It was more tangible than this. In fact, as I've had those experiences, I've decided that this is the foggy, weird dream, this life. That is what is real. And I held my baby boy. He was 14 months old at the time, and he was the same age in this instance as he was when he left the world. But I could feel him breathing. I could feel the heat of his body. I could feel his little soft head against my face, and I was just, and I felt the life and the light in every cell of his body. I was feeling it, and it was that tangible. And I was tangible, and we were there embracing, and I was holding him and marveling that I was here again and that I was in this situation. And as I was doing that, I felt someone come up behind me. And when I say someone, I felt a love so intense and so pure and so absolutely unconditional that I can't really hardly describe it. But as this person stood behind me and I held my son, this person helped me. And pure knowledge just began to flow through me. And I knew that I was in the presence of divinity. I hate it when I cry, by the way. It's just embarrassing. But as I experienced this and felt this love, there was no judgment. And I'll reiterate that. There was no judgment there. No more judgment than a dad that's watching his toddler learn to walk. It was just pure love. And what flowed to me was not only was I standing in the presence of divinity, but that I was divine, that we all were divine, that there was purpose in all of it. Everything that happens to us, it's by design. It's for a reason. It's for our learning. It's for our growth. There are no accidents. There are no tragedies. There is this life, which is this beautiful school of learning, and we chose it, and we create it. We do it so that we can learn and we can grow. And this was all flowing through me, and I knew it. I knew it to my core. And as I was experiencing that, more knowledge came that I, and this was all about choice. And what hit me is this beautiful being that stood behind me, which I felt was my divine creator, said, I want you to choose. This choice knowledge came through me that I got to choose. And this God, this being, this creator, this father, whatever word you want to put on it, said, I do not want you. And he didn't say anything. There was no words exchanged. That I heard an audible voice when he first approached, and he spoke about my deceased son and told me how special he was. But then the words stopped, and it was just pure knowledge flowing through. And the knowledge I got is, I say he said, I didn't hear it, I felt it. I do not want you to feel as if your son has been taken from you. I do not want you to hurt over this. I still cry, but he said, I want you to make a choice. I'm giving you the opportunity to give him to me. And as I held my little boy and this beautiful father held me, I got the privilege of kissing my little boy goodbye and giving him back. And that's something very few people get to do. I hesitate to even share that because I've shared that with people who say, I didn't get to do that. And that hurts. And then I feel bad that I shared that because it would hurt. But in my experience, I got to say goodbye. And I got to give him back. And as soon as I did that, I woke up. I was back in my bed in the hospital. And I woke my little brother up and said, I've had the most incredible dream. And I reiterated to him a few things that had happened. I very rarely share as much as I've just shared right now. But what I got in touch with was the absolute love and light and divinity that is in each one of us. To stand in the presence of God and feel his love and know how he saw me, and I'm just a normal guy, and trust me, I haven't lived any stellar life. I've done some stupid things, but I knew he loved me. And I knew everything I had done or had been done to me was for my learning and for my growth and for my perfection, and that I had actually chose it and created it. And that's what's odd. I said, well, why would I create this? Why would I create losing my family or having my body maimed or all these things? And yet in that moment, I knew it was absolutely perfect. I knew it was absolutely perfect, that it was meant to be no other way, and that all of that would serve me in some cosmic realm for my highest good. Doesn't mean I don't have bad days. I'll tell you that the strangest thing was having experienced that and then coming back and being in normal, everyday world life and longing for that. And as I came back home, and I talked about how I was in a wheelchair and my arm was bound up, and it was interesting. My brothers came, and we were going home from the hospital, and I was going to go stay with my younger brother where my son had been staying because I still needed home help, and there was all kinds of things to take place. And so they brought me to his house, and I really began to worry how Spencer was going to feel about this. He had come to the hospital and seen me, and he'd hop up on my bed, and we'd gone for little rides in the electric wheelchair around the halls of the hospital, but now I was coming home. This was it. I was going to be his dad. We were going to have to go to scouts. We were going to have to go do things, and it would never be the same. I mean, I couldn't run and throw him up in the air and play like I used to, and I also became very self-conscious about it. What do people think when they see me? Particularly, what would he think when he saw me? How would this feel in front of his friends or the neighbors? And so we made the trek down from the hospital. He lived in South Jordan, and we drove up, and my brothers got the wheelchair out, and they were assisting me with one leg and no arm, and I couldn't even stand on my left leg yet. Both legs were crushed. This leg still has six pins and a plate holding it together, so I really don't have a good leg. I've just got, my friends tease me and say, you don't have a leg to stand on, and they're probably right. But as my brothers were getting me out of the car, here came Spencer bolting out of the door. And I thought, oh, here he comes. And he ran right past me, boom. And I thought, oh, that he's here, he's in his element, this is odd, this is hard for him. And yet he ran right past me and started knocking on all the neighbors' doors. And he was only 7 at the time, and he was shouting, "Come out, come out, my dad's home." And he made his little round and ran back and jumped on my lap and about killed me. The pain, you know, he jumped up in my lap on that chair. And we still laugh about this. And I said, "Are you doing okay? Do you love me?" And he said, "If you," we still laugh. He said, "If you were nothing but a puddle of blood, I would still love you." And anyway, we hugged and all of my fears were immediately dismissed. And I knew that we were going to be just fine. God has been so good to me. I grieved for years. I had these beautiful experiences, yet I grieved for years. There was a hole in me so big that it could never be filled. And Tanya, my beautiful wife, who is a gift, she showed up in my life in a perfect way. I didn't date. I was so heartbroken, I didn't care to date. I was lonely. I was miserably lonely. I was a lonely man, but I had hired a nanny. I had a housekeeper. I was back to work. And Tanya just kind of dropped into my life in this magical, mystical way. And I knew immediately that she was the one. And that was hard. I spent some really weird afternoons up in the cemetery crying on my first wife's grave, saying, "I've fallen in love with another woman. What am I going to do?" And yet, in her special way, she said, "Of course you have. And that's exactly what I would want for you. And I've chosen her for you. So go for it." And we did. And yet I was extremely empty. It was unfair. I expected Tanya to fill my void. "You'll love me back to being better." That wasn't fair to her or to me or anybody else. And what I've come to understand through this whole process is that really nobody can fill the void except me. I get to fill the void. And that's the beautiful thing that I've come into touch with recently is what that means and how that's done. And I've spent all these years knowing that, gosh, I had this profound experience, and yet it's taken 15 years for me to really get in touch with what that was all about. It was about choice. It was about me choosing also to be happy. I had a profound experience at one point where I was so devastated by all of it. It would hit in waves. I would go for a year, 2 years, and that would hit me in waves. But on one particular occasion, I just crashed. I was just sobbing, saying, "Why? Why is all this going on?" I don't profess to talk to God all the time or anything like that, but on this particular occasion, as I poured my heart out, I felt that strength, that spirit that I had been in contact with. And it said audibly two words, or he said two words. It was very male for me in my experience. And he said, "Choose joy. Choose joy." In those two words, so much came to me. That was the whole point. "Look, I'm letting you come here. Choose this. Choose that. Choose joy, but choose to be happy." Not to receive validation from the outside in, but to receive validation from the inside out. To know that I'm the one that creates happiness and joy and peace for myself in spite of what happens, and maybe because of what happens. And that's been a beautiful process. And if I had any advice tonight or anything to say, is that what happens in our lives is perfect opportunities for us to choose the better part, to choose joy, to choose to learn and grow, and to not give up or to not be victimized or not say, "Why me?" But to literally embrace it as saying, "Wow, this is my perfect path. This is what I came here to do. This is what I came here to learn." And how loving is the universe or God, or again, whatever word you want to put on it, to provide me the opportunity to learn this, to walk this path and have it always. It never goes away. We get to just keep it. The other thing I would say is to get in touch with the divinity of who we really are. We're nothing lower than divine. We really are nothing lower than divine. It feels like we are at times, but we're not. We are literally sons and daughters of all there is. And that's a beautiful thing to know and get in touch with. And we're in such good hands. I sometimes think it's just a game. We're just playing this game. We're just children here. We're all brothers and sisters in love. And, oh, it hurts and we don't get it and that doesn't make sense. And why did this happen? But if we can just tap into, oh, we're connected. There's purpose in everything. We're all different and that's beautiful. And I get to show up and love people and portray that. When I was asked to speak and when I do this, people say, "Well, gosh, what gifts?" They think I come back with some kind of psychic gift or something. what special powers do you have from God? And many people do. I'm not diminishing that at all. We all have immense power. In fact, we all have such incredible powers. And that's the other thing I would like to stress, is there's nothing special about me except there is. And there's nothing special about you except there is. We are all so special. We're all so divine. We're all so connected with each other. And if I have any gift, it's to literally see people, to draw back on that out-of-body experience and see them. Look into their soul and say, wow, I see you for who you really are and for who you were created to be. I love that. I love being able to do that. I ran into a homeless guy just a couple days ago, and he came up, and of course he wanted money, and he was hungry, and my first ego reaction was, well, go away, there's a shelter, you'll be fine. And it's kind of interesting when you look at people like that. My heart said, look at him. Don't judge him, but look at him. And I looked into his eyes, and we didn't even say anything. We ended up just hugging each other on the street. I'm just here hugging this guy, and we just hugged. And of course, I had a couple bucks. I said, go up to Carl's Jr., get something off the dollar menu. That wasn't the gift that I gave him, nor was that the gift that I got. We connected. We connected spiritually, and I saw him, and I got to experience him and feel him as a brother and as a oneness, not as a homeless guy. And that's a beautiful thing. There's one thing I wanted to read. This is from an Indian chief, Native American, Chief Apamut, from Michigan. He wrote this in the 1700s. He said, when it comes time to die, be not like those whose hearts are filled with fear. When their time comes, they weep and pray for a little more time that they might live their lives over again and do things differently. When you die, sing your death song and die like a hero going home. My experience is that there is home, and it's a very loving place. And if we can tap into that, and begin to experience that unconditional love and that oneness. And I firmly know that's what we're here to do. That is the game we're playing, is to literally get in that space where we can love each other unconditionally, connect with each other. And that's what brings heaven to earth. We don't have to die to experience heaven. I experienced heaven hugging a homeless guy 2 days ago. There's nothing magic. Death is like walking from here to there. But life is here and now, and that's what we get, is the now. We have this moment to love and to live and to be who we are. Not who we think we are, but who we really are. Thank you for listening. Thank you for letting me bawl all over you.
Hi, thank you very much for your courage and intimacy with us tonight. I was curious when you were explaining it, as you returned your infant son to him, were you privileged to turn and face him?
No. I'm glad you asked that, because somehow in that circumstance, I did not turn around. I just felt it wasn't given. He held me from behind, and I actually laid my son back in the crib. That's how it went down for me. So I didn't turn around. I didn't see the person. I felt them and experienced them without looking at them.
Correct me if I'm what you said inaccurately. You said that you learned that we create our circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope this is unkind to ask this, but how would you, the two Powell children that were murdered by their father, how would you react to that? What would you say they created that? What would you have to say about that situation?
It's interesting you bring that up. We talked about this last night, my wife and I. I would say, number one, there are no surprises or accidents here, but there's also choice. We all have choice. I also know that it's not my place to judge any of it, and that's difficult. It's disturbing to me what happened. Don't misunderstand me. Very disturbing to me what happened. But the greatest master I know said, judge not that you be not judged. I do know that in some cosmic realm there is a purpose. I don't know what that is. It's not my place to say. But I do know that there is a purpose and a reason for everything. And I try to stay out of what's right and what's wrong, because I don't know. I don't know what was discussed. I don't know what was agreed upon. I don't know what contracts people came here with. It's disturbing to me, but I choose not to judge it. I don't know. all the circumstances. I feel sometimes, gosh, what happened to a soul to put them in a place that they would make a choice in such a way? But then again, then I begin to move into a right, wrong, I'm judging this thing, where really it's not my place. So I don't know.
Having had such a really intimate experience with your Creator, you know, during that moment, how has that affected your ability to reconnect with Him since that time?
In a very positive way. Knowing home, I can get back home. And actually, I do. I meditate all the time, pray, whatever you want to call it. I've always said praying is talking and meditating is listening. I listen a lot more than I talk, and that's a big shift based on the experience.
And is there anything that you could maybe give to us as insights in terms of how we could create that experience on a personal level for us?
You know, I will do that, and thank you for asking, because there was a very interesting insight as I stood and looked at my own body from outside my body and seeing how broken it was. And like I said, it was almost repulsive, and yet I felt this love and this drawn to it. I have gotten in touch with my body as my temple. You hear that in sacred and holy books, that your body is a temple. You know ye not that you're the temple of God and God dwells within you? I have come to a point where I view my body as just that. It is the temple I'm in. And deep in the core of my heart is a holy of holies, where I can go and commune with my Creator. And the shift for me was, instead of always looking outward to things, was to going inward and looking inward for things, and literally visualizing myself going within myself into that sacred place of my heart, this core or holy of holies of my temple, where I can find my Creator and commune with Him in a very real and positive way. That's what works for me. There's no set system. What works for you works for you. That's what works for me. But it's going within instead of looking without.
Thank you for sharing your story. You're the second person that I've heard speak here, and there's some consistencies from the story from when they meet their Creator. Mm-hmm. And what I wonder and suspect is the reason that you got to say goodbye to your son is that, you know, that we have a Creator that knows what support you need to carry on with your mission, whether it be there or here. And what I take from that is the possibility that He allowed you to have that very tangible experience, knowing what was ahead of you, that you would need that to be able to move forward in whichever direction that you go. And the person that I heard speak here before, I got that same feeling, and I don't know if that's how you possibly see it. And just one other thing, I just wondered if it was known why, what caused the accident, or why the car lost control.
Okay. We're so loved, and we do get just what we deserve, what we need, or what best serves our path and our development and our process. I do embrace the truth that I got that because that's what I deserve to have. The accident. There was strong crosswinds. They say it was 110 miles an hour. There was talk of a little red pickup that was swerving and cutting people off. I think I fell asleep at the wheel, quite honestly. And that has been a very tough thing to deal with. The guilt of knowing that I somehow was accountable for what may have happened. And maybe that's why I deserve to have the spiritual experiences, is to carry me through that, that there really are no accidents, that regardless of what happened, it's part of my perfect path in a very temporary world. That's what's funny. Having been there, I look at this world as such a, it seems like we're here and it's so real, and it is, but it's not. This is just such a drop in the bucket, the knowledge that I've always existed. Now, I've existed before here, and I'm going to exist long after this. So it's just a little teeny window, and so in the big scheme of things, does anyone really ever die? Is anyone really ever gone? I will assure you, I have guardian angels by me, and I've encountered them. My son is no longer the little baby. He's quite a brawny guy. I've encountered him as an adult and had the experience of doing that as well, and somehow that serves. So in this little speck of a moment we call life, it's important, but it's really just part of learning. We're just here to learn, and whatever comes up, that's what serves us. So if I fell asleep at the wheel, then I guess in some cosmic realm, that was meant to be, because I certainly didn't do it on purpose or by choice, but it still is what happened. We're human, but we're not. We say we're human, and we are. We're in this dimension, this realm, but we are beings of light. We are divine, having a very human experience. That's what I learned through this stuff, is that the humanness of us is not who we are. The divine part of us is who we really are.
You mentioned that you had a feeling of pure knowledge coming into you. Can you speak a little bit about what kind of knowledge that was, and if you were able to bring some of that back with you?
It was a comprehension. Again, the hardest thing is explaining this, but in that moment, it's as if I was part of everything. It was as if there were no separation between me and everything that there is. It's like my body or my spiritual body, because I believe I was out of the body experiencing this, and yet I was very tangible. I felt that I had matter to me, but that melted into everything, so that there was no separation. I was not separate. I was one with all of it. And the knowledge that flowed in was this pure unconditional love, that there is purpose to everything, that there is no accident, that what I was experiencing was absolutely perfect, that it was part of my personal designed program for my path to walk, and that there was always a reason for it. And that's really the best I can explain. It isn't like, oh, suddenly I knew math. It wasn't like that. But it was like suddenly math didn't matter, except the divine geometry of everything that had ever been created and why. And yet it almost felt like it had all been created for me. And I know that sounds so strange, but our individual experiences, it is. Everything you go through or experience, your love, your joy, it is. It is divinely created for you. And that's important and special we are. And that's what was flowing through me is, wow, this is all for me. It's humbling and yet invigorating at the same time.
When you met your wife on the other side, she had obviously only been there for a short time.
Right.
And she said, you've got to go back. Mm-hmm. Did you get the sense that she was grieving because she had to send you back, that she would miss you even though she was in this glorious place?
That's yes. In fact, she was distraught. She was in tears. And it was odd because I was comforting her. Oh, it's going to be okay. And she was crying and saying, you've got to go back. You've got to go back. You can't be here. You cannot be here. And she was very distraught. And I have felt that our emotions and our feelings, even though we're in a beautiful place, we're not that far separated from each other. So my experience was that she was very distraught. And yes, she had only been there a short time. I don't know what realm we were in, but I know that I had left the accident and was in a place of light and love, but she was upset. And it was not a peaceful, pleasant goodbye as far as that goes, yeah.
Thank you for being so open and honest with us. That was a privilege. Thank you. My question is, you've talked about the perfect plan, or that it's all part of your prescription. This is what I signed up for. Are we drifting into a place where you could say it's predestined, or is it, where does choice and...
No, that's a good question. I wouldn't say predestined, but I think we make choices every second of every day. We choose and create almost on the fly, step by step as we go through. Where choice plays in, though, is how we react or what we do in any given situation. Things will happen in life that we have no control over. Even if we did agree in some distant realm that, yes, I will go through that, but I always believe we have choice right now to do with what we will. We can't choose the tests, but we get to choose the answers we give, right? Predestiny, I don't know, except I would say we're all predestined for divinity. That's what I felt. We are all on a path to home. And I say that boldly, no matter where you come from, what you're doing, what religion you are, whatever that looks like for you, we're all on a path home. That is the predestiny, is to get home, and that we'll go through all kinds of different diverse experiences. And the choice comes in with how we live within those things that happened.
Jeff, thank you. Tonight's touched my heart on many levels. Two questions. You talked about guardian angels, yes, and if you have more information about that. And then could you talk about purpose and how does somebody know what their purpose is?
Guardian angels. Angels is an interesting word, but yes, I firmly embrace the knowledge of guardian angels. I have a deceased wife and a son that watch over me continually. I've also felt the presence of angels that I may not know, that I may not know at least in this realm. I know that they're not that far away. They are so close to us, and we feel as if there's this huge separation, and my experience has been that there's not. And they are joyful to kind of the goodbye to my first wife of her being distraught. I have felt her joyfulness on many times beyond that. Her absolute elated joy in something I might learn. Oh, wow, now I get it. And I'll feel her joy as if she's applauding, saying, see, I think they laugh a lot at me. It's like, God, look at him now. You know, when's he going to get it? I think from there perspective. Now, I think the goodbye we said was so near to what had just happened that it wasn't a peaceful thing. But now, where time doesn't exist for them and it's all part of the plan, it's like watching Tough Mudders. They're going through all this stuff, and I think they're just cheering us on and watching and knowing that they're there. And I call on them. I call on them all the time by merely presencing them with me. The second part to your question, purpose. That's a very personal path. And again, almost like the question over here about going within and asking. And sometimes it's not a great purpose. It's not, gosh, people have said, boy, your life was spared for a great purpose. Yeah, to kiss my kids goodnight at night. That's a great purpose. Maybe I was preserved to hug that homeless guy. It doesn't have to be a big, huge purpose. I think our purpose is to remember who we are. Universally, you know, we all have separate purposes, but to me and for me, the universal purpose of humankind is to finally remember, and I use that word consciously. It's we come here and we don't remember where we came from. We're disjointed. Our purpose is to literally pull that all back together and say, oh, now I remember. And that's what I experienced. I think in that brief moment, I was experiencing, oh, now I remember who I am. And that's a universal purpose. Individual purposes. Maybe you're going to be a famous rock star, and maybe you're meant to be somebody's babysitter on that perfect night when you tell them about love and they never forget it for the rest of their life. I don't know.
Hi, I'm curious about your son's experience of it all, if he has memories or if it's something that, I mean, because he was so little, if that's something that he still remembers or if it's something that has kind of been shaded over.
No, he remembers it very well. And it was very traumatic for him in some instances. Now, it was interesting. At the scene of the accident, as the doctor was taking him and getting him away, and they got a blanket for him to wrap up in and in a safe place, and this has been relayed to me. I didn't experience this. This is what was told to me by the people at the scene of the accident. He said, where's my mom? They said, oh, she's over there. Of course, they knew what was going on. And he said, no, she's not. She's right here with me. So he was having an experience of that kind too. He says everything went slow motion for him. He remembers watching his little Star Wars toys fluttering through the air in such slow motion that he was sitting there watching it all happen as if time just stopped. Interesting kid. He went through a long period of life where even though he had had this spiritual experience of mom's right here, he kind of let that go. And he walked a path of there is no God. Somebody loves me and lets this happen to me. Are you kidding? I don't get it. And yet he's found a beautiful path of his own too. And that was interesting as a father to say, wow, I just get to let him walk. I get to realize his path is not my path. And he gets to walk it. And recently he's come into situations too where he said, wow, now I get it, and it all makes sense. And yet he teaches me things too. During that time frame when I was so broken and so distraught, he's just put his arm around me and say, it's going to be okay. You know, it's going to be okay. And yet there were times he would go up to the grave sites and lay on the and literally just pull the grass in absolute agony as to why did this happen. He remembers it, and he has had his own experience, and it's made him such a strong amazing kid. And he's a man now. I mean, he'll be 22 at the end of the month. He's a young man, but he is very, at this point, enlightened. But it's almost as if he had to go through this darkness before he could ever come up to where he saw light. And the beautiful thing is now he gets it both. He's like, oh, I know that and I know this. Therefore, I've had all of it. And he just is grateful. He just says every day, I'm grateful for my life and what I've learned. And that's what he's taught me. I'm quoting him half the stuff I say. He's a very enlightened young man.
I've studied for a long time now ancient to modern near-death experiences. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a common thread. And so this leads to my question. We hear a lot about that you're going home. I went home. I saw spirits preparing to be born. There's artworks in early Christianity that show spirits coming down from heaven. So my question is, in this flood of knowledge that you had, did you ever get an understanding of who you were before you were born?
Not who I was specifically, but that I was divine, as are all of us. That's what I got, is that I had always existed. I was as ancient as the one standing with me, but I was just in a different process. I didn't see spirits being born or anything like that. My peaks into the other side were very brief. Since I've had this, I've read other things, and people have had immense experiences and met ancestors and had long conversations and seen the spirit. Mine were little peaks into the veil, and yet in those peaks came such floods of information. But who I was a son of God. That's as plain and simple as I can put it. And every much a son as anyone ever had been. That's what it felt like. And that's very hard to share in an open forum like that. That's what I felt, is that I was a child of God and a son of God as much as anyone had ever been.
And my second question is about that very thing you're talking about, where, again, in ancient near-death experiences and even modern ones like Howard Storm, George G. Ritchie, I've heard a lot of them. They talk about the ultimate destiny of the human family is that we're going back home to a realm we came from, that we're progressing towards, as Howard Storm said, to become co-creators with the gods in the universe. Is that what you're talking about when you're talking about that we're divine, that we're spiritual beings having a physical experience, that this is just a momentary school type of place?
That's what it feels like for me. I mean, we must have been crazy. Why would we do this? Why would we come here to this lower realm, forget who we were, go through all kinds of hell and everything else? Why would we do that? And I think it's because we are so noble. We are the noble and great ones who said, yeah, let's go do that. Because in the end, that's the only way we'll ever learn. We can sit here and talk about it, or we can go down and experience it. And I think the experience is the true teacher in the end. And there probably is no other way to really get it. And we'll probably go back and laugh about it all and say, oh, remember what happened, and that was silly, and that was funny, and that was sad, but it doesn't matter anymore.
Knowing yourself before this experience, and obviously knowing yourself better now after the experience, do you feel like you would have been bitter or maybe not able to forgive yourself had you not had these, as we call them, near-death experiences? And the other question I have is, your parents-in-law, did it take them a long time to forgive what happened, or did, I'm just curious, did you share these experiences with them? Did that assist them in their view of getting past it?
My in-laws I'm actually very close to. My first mother-in-law has passed away, and it was interesting because they were hurt. They never judged me. I was so fearful of seeing them. My first wife's dad is 6'6", big old guy. He was a former athlete. He was a coach. He's a famous coach. He's won more state basketball championships than anybody in the country, I think. I think he has 12 state basketball championships or something. He was the first one of the family to come see me. And it was several days after. They were dealing with the death and working with that. And as he came in the room, and of course I was on a respirator, I couldn't talk to him, there was nothing I could say. And he came in the room and he laid over my chest and just wept. And I hugged him and we just cried. it was very painful for them. I think my first wife's mother really struggled. And yet it was beautiful because as she got ready to pass on, and I had remarried, and that she was uncomfortable with that too. And not in a negative way. She's a beautiful, loving woman, but we do have a human part of us that makes it hard. As she got ready to pass on, it became very beautiful. We would go visit her, and she would embrace Tanya and tell her how much she loved her, and thank you for coming to raise my grandson and to be a part of the life of this family that means so much to us. And then it was interesting, as she passed away, and my father-in-law remarried almost immediately. He's like, oh, wow, gosh, that's really hard to be on your own. He is a tender, beautiful man, and we're very close. We see each other often. I spoke to him 2 days ago on the phone. It was tough, but like I say, everybody let it go. They let go of the judgment. They embraced forgiving and saying, hey, it happened, it's done, it hurts, but in the big scheme of things, it was a little lesson we get to take on and learn. And I have shared these experiences with them. And my father-in-law had an experience as well shortly after the accident. I say shortly after, it was months after. It was months after the accident. He had a dream where his daughter, my wife, came to him, and she was so joyful, so happy. And he kept saying to her, this can't be real. And she said, oh, it's real. Trust me, it's real. And she embraced him and assured him that everything was perfect, everything was fine. And she said, please be happy because I am so happy. And that was very healing for him. And again, I hesitate to share those things because so many people won't have that happen. I had these spiritual experiences, and yet I went in through the next months just begging, let me just see him. Can I just have one glimpse again of something? And bitterness, I've been bitter, I've been hurt, I've been angry, I've been all of it, in spite of what I experienced. I embrace that too. That's all part of the thing we call life, right? But I think these things assist us and do help us move forward. Time is healing, and yet you never get over it. I thought, tonight I can tell this story and I'll be fine. I can face these people and speak and not blubber all over everyone. I will never get over it. I get used to it, and yet I can embrace the blessing of it and the lesson of it and the wisdom of it. And that was another thing in that realm when you talk about pure knowledge. I realized that nothing existed but wisdom. It didn't matter. All the things we think matter so much, what I did or didn't do or said or did I fall asleep. The judgment was gone because all that existed is wisdom. That's all there was light, truth, and wisdom. There was no, all the other stuff didn't exist.
Jeff, you've displayed a lot of courage in doing this. Not too long ago, I knew people who lived their whole lives afraid to reveal anything from the other side for fear of ridicule. We're living in a little more liberal environment that way. It still took a lot of courage. My question is, at the time or since, your wife, your son, your Savior, or anybody else, did they give you any instruction that you feel comfortable or can recall at those times that you can share with us?
Yeah, actually they did, and it was very simple. And again, I think you get whatever is perfect for you. I was asked one very poignant question. I can quote it verbatim to this day. I said there was no judgment, there was nothing but wisdom, but there was a question for me, and the question was, to what degree have you learned to love? That was the question. And it wasn't, have you learned to love, it was to what degree have you learned to love? And I'll never forget that. And to me, that was the instruction. It wasn't necessarily an answer, it was a question. And I think sometimes the most powerful things in our lives are questions, not necessarily answers, because we get to find our own answers, right?
In the realm of prayers, what have you personally discovered what prayers does for you, praying does for you, and the interaction that occurs with your Creator and other angels, relatives that are involved?
Prayer is a big thing for me, and I try to take time every morning. I call it prayer or meditation, and like I say, praying for me, I don't spend tons of hours talking on my knees. I get in a place where I can really hear and listen. There's another verse from a holy book that says, be still and know that I am God. That be still is big for me. Being still, being a place where I can be still and listen and being open to whatever comes up. And it's funny, when I really connect, because I mean, you know what, I go through my days and I might go weeks and never really connect with my Creator in a prayer, even though I might be going through the motions or through the process. When I really connect, I know I've connected because I have floods of gratitude. There's nothing but thankfulness that comes through in spite of the situation. Tanya's funny. She thinks I'm the biggest ball baby. She'll find me in the closet bawling or whatever. And what happened this time? She knows. But when I really connect, I feel nothing but gratitude. And that's how I know. It's like, wow, I know I've connected. And it's a matter of being still and being at peace. Not begging and pleading, but literally being at peace and being open to receive whatever it is that's being given.
I appreciate your story tonight because my wife and I have had experiences with the other side, kind of on a minimal level. But I've got two questions. Your son is, what's he like now? Is he okay with it? You talked a little bit about it. What's he learned about it? And then where was the accident? Where did it take place?
Yeah, the accident took place in Parowan, mile marker 80. It's weird. It's a little place under an overpass right in Parowan outside of Cedar City.
I know where that is exactly.
Okay, that's where it took place. My son has done really well. He, and I'll be as brief as I can. After the accident, when Tanya and I got married and she came into our life and she said, Spencer's not quite right. And I said, oh, he's been through a lot. You've just got to let that go. And she, being a very wise and loving woman, looked into it a little bit. We found he was diagnosed with Asperger's. It's a very high-functioning form of autism. Very distant, had a hard time connecting with people. He connected very well with me, and that may be the blessing of this whole thing, as he and I were very, very tight through our whole process. But we got him assistance and things to help him mainstream. And the thing that connected for him was music. He became infatuated with music. He played the bass guitar at a young age. We started him, he was about 12. He started playing bass guitar, and he would just play this guitar, and he loved the vibration, he loved the way it felt, and he would play by ear, totally learning things. We enrolled him in something called the School of Rock. There literally is one. It's like the Jack Black movie, and in fact, there's one in Salt Lake. He just excelled in that. The music was everything, and he would write things. He talked about how finally he could express himself, but he had a shield in front of him that protected him as he did this, you know, the big bass guitar being the shield and the music coming out of it being the vibration that he was putting out and his expression. He excelled at that and was named as one of the all-stars that got to travel all over the country. They'd pick kids out of each state and put together a little band that would travel all over the country. And I got to be the roadie. I'd drive the van, you know, with all the gear in it while they toured in the air-conditioned bus in front of me. He did well by hiding in his music, and I say hiding because he just dumped himself into it. Now, he was brilliant in school, straight-A student, did very well, struggled with friends and relationships. And I'm only giving you this background because later in life, as he started to have these spiritual awakenings, he said, I feel a calling. I feel like I'm now connected, and there's something I get to do. So he filled out papers to go do a church mission. And he filled out his papers and put them in. And of course, he filled them out very honestly. And one of the questions was, have you ever been diagnosed with a mental disorder, A, B, C, Asperger's, And he says, well, yeah, I've been diagnosed with Asperger's. The papers came back rejected because they said, we do not send, you know, missionaries out that have Asperger's. This is something you can have an honorable medical release. And he said, no, I'm cured of that. I've found my peace, I found God. And he went back to all the psychiatrists that did these analyses and saw a church psychiatrist. They said, we can find no Asperger's in this kid. He's literally cured. There's no existence of it in him. So that's what he's doing right now, is he's doing a church mission down in California, loves it, and yet he's an incredible soul because he shows up in love. He's not there to judge or to convert or to condemn. He's simply there to love and serve, and people really resonate with that because that's truth in the end. So he had a rough time, but he got over it, and maybe all this Asperger's diagnosis was simply his soul kind of hiding and mourning and grieving until he finally found light and stepped into the truth of who he was and moved forward. you.